Hello everybody and welcome to The Room, the podcast brought to you from LFC Transfer Room. I'm Richie and I'll be one of your co-hosts today. Alongside me is YouTube sensation Matty Orme. How are you today, Matty?
Doing really well. It's roasting in England today, isn't it? So it's a bit horrible, but yeah, I'm doing good.
Yeah, we shouldn't complain too much though, because we don't get too much hot weather. So we won't complain too loudly, just in case, you know, the gods of thunder come. We're also joined by our podcast extraordinaire, Daz O'Connor. How are you, Daz?
I'm good. It's actually cold here. It's 105 degrees.
Yeah, Daz is our expat in Texas. So we're complaining about the hot weather and it's nothing compared to what Daz has got.
No, no. We're supposed to hit 115 in a week.
Get your sun cream out.
Yeah, t-shirt and swim shorts. That's the look.
Absolutely. And we are joined today by a very, very special guest, Thomas Gronemark, who is joining us as one of Liverpool's coaching staff. And you'll all know him as the set piece extraordinaire himself as well, I suppose, as well. And we're going to ask Thomas lots of questions regarding Liverpool and regarding his profession. How are you, Thomas?
Yeah, I'm pretty fine. Yeah, recovering from jet lag. So, but I'm I'm beginning to be fine here in Denmark. So that's great.
Yeah, I can imagine all of the traveling takes its toll. Although at least you can travel now after the couple of years that we've had.
Yeah, it's been much better here from July. So at least until now, it's a pretty normal preseason for me. So I think I've been traveling to, I don't know, 5 or 6 countries here since July. So yeah, I'm up and going again. So I really love it.
Good. So like, thank you again, like, for joining us. You know, it's wonderful to have you on, and we obviously have questions for you, and you know, I'm sure you would have heard some of them before, but for our listeners and for us as well, it's perhaps the first time, so I apologise. But I suppose the first real question is, like, it's quite a niche market that you're in, dealing with set pieces and in particular throw-ins. How did you get into this profession, really, and how did you get into this coaching role?
Yeah, just to make a long story short, you can say I have a background in football myself, playing the best U19 league in Denmark. Also played against, for example, Thomas Graversen, you later know from Celtic and Real Madrid. And so then I had, because I wasn't good enough to be a pro football player, I had 6 years on a Danish athletics national team as a sprinter. And then I went on, after that, 4 years on the Danish national bobsleigh team, traveling all around the world, crashing many times, been beaten up and so on. And I don't know if I hit my head, but in January 2004, I got the thought, hey, if I can make a really good throw in myself, can't I teach other players to do it? So I went to my local library to find that book about throw-ins, but there were no books at all, so I had to make my own course. And yeah, after 6 months, I had the course, but I didn't know if it would work. So, but I could have been starting with a youth amateur team, but I contacted my local Superliga team called Vibor, and luckily enough, they said yes. They scored a lot of goals on throw-ins that season. Had their best place in the Danish Superliga ever in the club's history. So all in all, it was a success story. Year after, I came to FC Midtjylland, an even better club in Denmark. And then, yes, for many years I coached many Danish Superliga teams. Also was 2 years in, for example, Brentford. But then, as many know, I got my big international breakthrough in July 2018, where Jürgen Klopp called me directly on my phone to ask for help to make Liverpool's throw-ins better. So, I'm a throwing coach. I'm the only one in the world, and, still love it. I have a fantastic life, as you mentioned yourself before, traveling a lot. And, you know, I'm able to help some of the best teams in the world, and, you know, living from what I love the most. So from my point of view, it can't be better.
What players have improved the most under your stewardship, then, would you say, in football?
Yeah, you can say, I would like to divide it up in, because I have this philosophy called the long, the fast, and the clever throw-in philosophy. And with your question, I'd like to divide the answer up in two. First of all, you can say the long throw-in, who has been the best? And I'll say again, most of my players, when I'm coaching them over a period, so several times with the long throw-in technique, most players are improving between 5 and 15 meters. And the reason why they can that is because I use approximately 30 different technical parameters and use video analysis too. So it's only technical training. And for example, I had this guy from FC Midtjylland, Kian Hansen. He might not be the one who improved the most. He improved from... from 30 to approximately 37, but he assisted 35 goals on the long throw in for FC Midtjylland in the Danish Superliga. So approximately 9 goals from long throw ins per season in 4 seasons. So that was like really crazy. And in these 4 years, Midtjylland also had 2 Danish championships, and the first one of it was the first in the club's history. So, but I've had a lot of players, for example. A young Danish player called Andreas Paulsen, who improved from 24.25 to 37.90, so almost 14 meters. And he was sold to Borussia Mönchengladbach as an 18-year-old player from Midtjylland for 4 million euros, I think it was, in 2018. So that was like a long-throwing success story. But also one long-throwing success story I like to point out is Andy Robertson, because... yeah, he'll never be one of the best in the world to throw far, but when I started with him in Liverpool FC in July 2018, he could only throw about 19 meters, and that's really short, and probably one of you three in there can probably throw further than 19 meters. So but the challenge with 19 meters was that every time Liverpool had a throw-in in the left side, because Robo couldn't throw longer, it was really easy for the opponents to put on pressure, because you can't throw to many teammates then. But he improved his throw-in to, at least for now, 27 meters, or approximately 8 meters. But he also improved his throw-in area, and that's like the half circle you can throw in when you, let's say, have a throw-in in the middle of the pitch. He improved that throw-in area with more than 500 square meters. So even though he's improved many other things, you can also say he's also actually a long throw-in success story, even though he'll never be one of the best in the world for that. So that's like one part of my answer. The second part of my answer is around what I call the fast and clever throw-in. And to cap it all in very fast, you can say that fast and clever throw-ins is all about getting the ball fast, react fast, take a fast decision to throw it fast, or wait and have patience. Of course, fast throw-ins is also when the opponents have a throw-in to mark fast, communicate fast, and so on and so on. And the clever throw-in is again, to explain shortly, that's all about space creation. How can we create space in the pitch? And for the thrower, you can say that he has to see the best space being created, also in the different kinds of space you have in the three zones. And if I have to pick two players out there, I'll again pick up out the Robo and then Trent, because when I came to Liverpool, the level of awareness and so what was pretty low. But again, I'll say that's natural when you have never really been coaching the throw-ins before. But in like I don't know, a month or so, Robo went from pretty bad to world class, and Trent took a few more months. But for me, that's at the moment the two best. Fast and clever throwers in the world at the moment. But it's also important for me to say that one thing is the throwers, but the second thing is also the teammates out there who has to create space, and they are at least as important as the throw itself. So no matter if you're having a throw-in, you have to attack, keep possession, create a chance, or you have to defend a throw-in when the opponent have it. It's teamwork. You're counting in all players on the pitch, not normally the goalkeeper, but all 10 outfield players. They're like in it, no matter if it's an attacking or defending throw-in. So yes, but I've if I also count in amateur youth players, I've been coaching several thousand players in my career, and I'll say that. That Robo and Trent, looking at the fast and clever throw-ins, they're like, at least at the moment, they're the best. But we also have to remember that it's my fourth season in Liverpool, so they've been getting a lot of throw-in coaching, you know. So and it's absolutely possible for other players to to come on up on that level, they just have to like get the right training.
Thomas, I wanted to ask you, has anything changed technique-wise from last season?
No, not really. You can say the big challenge with me and Liverpool FC and the throwing coaching has the biggest chance, sorry, change and challenge has actually been the travel regulation to UK. Because let's just take the first half of 2021. You know, I could travel to France. I could travel many places. Of course, some countries have been like open and closed, like you know it. But UK has been almost impossible to come into. So my biggest challenge with throwing coaching Liverpool FC is that I couldn't actually come to to the players. I've been analyzing all the games the last 3 seasons and this season too, via the video. But of course, it's much better when I come to the pitch and learn the players some things on hand and learn them specific drills and so on and so on. So I'll say, the biggest challenge for me have been the travel regulations and restrictions regarding UK. So yeah.
I suppose, like you've mentioned already, you know, the players like Trent and Robbo who have improved with their throw-ins, etc. But, you know, on a grander scale since 2018, what impact has the club had, you know, in terms of throw-ins? So, like, if we look at Liverpool and how they were, you know, their set pieces at the end of the day, you know, how have they improved? Because, you know, there never seemed to be too many goals created from throw-ins unless it was like there was a really famous English Premier League player, Rory Delap, who had a huge throw-in and it was just like the long throw into the box, you know. So to see it at Liverpool, where you've said, like, we don't have the longest throw-ins in the world, how have you, you know, since 2018, been able to measure that impact?
I'll say, first of all, we actually have some really good throwers in the team. For example, Joe Gomez, who can really like throw like D-Lab. And we also have, I can't reveal them here, but we have actually several other players who can make a really long throw in also in normal start 11 and so, but we just choose not to do it in Liverpool. It's not really the playing style of Liverpool. And why not that, will people say? Yeah, but you can say, let's just go back to FC Midland, who scored 35 goals in 4 seasons, but they also took like 10, 12, 15 long throw ins in every game. Hey, and do we want to see that at Anfield? No. In Liverpool FC, we rather want that fast play, that attacking, that energy who goes on and on and on. And you can easily get that with the fast and clever throw-ins. So yes, we could score goals on long throw-ins easily, I'll say, with the quality of throwers and the technique we could have on long throw-ins. But it'll just change the playing style of Liverpool FC. And I don't think that anyone is interested in that. Yes, of course, when the long throwing goal is scored itself, yeah, you will cheer and you will say, yeah, that was great. But all in all, I don't think you want to see that at a Liverpool team. I'm not saying we'll never, ever, ever use a long throw-in, but it'll just not be very often. And then I'll say the second thing regarding the question. Some people are saying, oh, you're only scoring after throw-in if it's a long throw-in. No, we actually, the last 3 seasons, full season here, we scored between 10 and 14 goals after throw-in situations. It's not just a long, it's about creating space. And actually, we scored several, pretty many goals after throw-ins at our own penalty area too. So it's about creating space, find out where it's good to create space. And then if we create space in a danger situation on the pitch, we can like make a count or switch the play. We have so many opportunities there with my training and philosophy. So we scored a lot of goals after throw-in situations. There are just not many of them like the media has seen. Of course, there are some real like clear ones like I think the winner against Spurs. The winner against Wolverhampton, you know, all the media saw that because it happened at their penalty area and we just scored like shortly after. But we scored so many goals that the media hasn't seen because they're focusing on other things. But it started with space creation with a throw-in. So again, I'll say we scored a lot of goals there. And then back again to the first part of the question, where have Liverpool improved? I like to say, of course, I have I have a lot of data. Liverpool FC has a lot of their own data too, and I just can't reveal that because it's like normally when you sign a contract, there are something you can't say. So the things I'm saying now is a company called Tifo Football who made that, and I don't know if you heard it, but in the 17-18 season, the season before I came to Liverpool, where the team had a fourth place in the Premier League and Champions League final, lost to Madrid, Liverpool had a possession on throw-ins under pressure on 45.4%. And the throw-in under pressure is where the players are marked. That will say you don't count in the throw-ins where the opponents are 20 or 30 meters away, because that doesn't really matter, you know. There'll be a possession no matter what. But Liverpool had a possession in the 17-18 season on 45.4% and were actually only number 18 in the Premier League, third last in the Premier League. So it was totally right what Jurgen Klopp said. They were really bad at the throw-ins, losing the ball almost every time. But in my first season, in the 18-19 season, we improved from 45.4% to 68.4% and went from number 18 in the Premier League to number 1 in the Premier League. Also number 2 in the whole Europe, just after one of my teams at that point, at least, FC Midtjylland, who were number 1. So we have improved a lot. We actually also had sorry, but I can't remember the source here, but there was actually also a pretty new thing regarding the 2021 Premier League, that was about the fast throw-ins. They make this graph where on the x-axis they had like what is the average time of a throw-in. They had that on the x-axis, and then on the y-axis they had like how many really fast throw-ins in under 5 seconds does the team take out of like 100, so that's like the percentage. And if you took these two, and yeah, I can show you that later, then Liverpool was far ahead of all other teams. So I've on social media I heard some people writing, oh, they are taking way too long with the throw-ins, and that's a mess, and they're way too slow. And but actually, the times where we are waiting, that's, first of all, it's because we want to create space and not because we don't know what to do, but we were waiting for the right space. And then the statistics say we are way the fastest team to take throw-ins all in all in the Premier League, at least in last season. But I guess I'm 100% sure it was the same the other season. So that's also a part of the strategy. So without... how do you say in English, blowing my own trumpet too much, or horn, you say something like that. Yeah. I'll say that Liverpool has improved in every parameter, both with possession, with goal scoring after throw-in situations, but also with taking fast throw-ins, and every parameter is a part of the success. And some other people have said, oh, throw-ins, that's like small gains, that's marginal gains, we are, you know. But hey, for me, they're totally wrong. Throw-ins are gigantic gains, because you have 40 to 60 throw-ins in a match normally. The last thing I read was average was 47 throw-ins in the Premier League. So it's not a few situations, it's so many situations in a game. The only reason why some call it marginal gains or small gains is because we have underestimated throw-ins or neglected throw-ins in football history. Imagine we are playing in a game where we're playing about billions of pounds and dollars and euros, and we've been playing 140 years and no one have cared about throw-ins. See a pretty normal football match. If a guy or a team lose the ball after throw-in situation, the commentators, the pundits, they're not saying nothing at all. But if you do the same in the middle of the pitch when you have the ball at your feet, you'll say, hey, he's not good enough for that team, or is he good enough to be a professional, or that good enough for that league? So, but you know, it has the same consequence to lose a ball at a throw-in like it has in the middle of the pitch. You can either win or lose a game in that single situation. So for me, throw-ins are gigantic games. It's only because of the neglection of in 140 years that we are not talking more about it. So again, like you probably noticed, is my it's my goal in one of my goals in life to change that in football. So yeah,
I mean, you can see
I think there's two things there, really, like where you said about you know, blowing your own horn. I always say if you can back it up, then you've got every right to blow your own horn. So, you know, and you have backed it up. I think the main thing, like from what you said, was that possession game. Liverpool went from 45% to in the 60s. And that's huge because possession, like it or not, the more possession you have, the more likely you are to win a football match. So, I think that there's some amazing stats there that you've given us and, you know, a real insight to how important throw-ins are, you know, just as any set pieces. Sorry, Matty, I cut across you, mate.
No, I was just going to say, from if you watch Liverpool games back before Thomas came in to now, you will notice the difference. I think if you're watching, you notice how Liverpool's movement, even defending corners, is so much better now than before you came in. So is that something you work on as well, like defending corners?
No, actually not. I'm only about throw-ins. I don't do anything.
I mean throw-ins.
Yeah, only do throw-ins.
Yeah, that's what I mentioned. Work with the defending throw-ins from the opposition as well, because I think Liverpool's movements improved even when the opposition has a throw-in. I think Liverpool have massively improved in their defensive of that as well.
Yeah, that's totally crazy, and I can just say that I think we held, regarding my days, I think we held Chelsea down to like I don't know, 26% or so in the last game here. We didn't have many throw-ins under pressure ourselves because, I think Chelsea stood low after the red card for them. So I think we had 100% possession, but a very few under pressure because, you know, they just let us throw it back because they were outnumbered. But they had really many throw-ins under pressure. And as I remember, Chelsea were down to a possession of 26%. So that was defending throw-ins out of another world. So I can only say that for me, that we are for sure the best team in the world to defend throw-ins. And you know, it's just as important to attacking throw-ins. And so I'm working with everything around the throw-ins. We are also scoring many goals when the opponents have a throw-in because, you know, it can really be a weak point for a team if they lose it. And one thing is that you're losing it down at the opponent's penalty area because then they have like 100 meters up to our goal, but if you're losing it in your own half or near your own penalty area, it's like you can almost score a direct goal from that, at least in a few seconds. So we are really strong at, and that's like, it's not like saying, hey, oh, remember to defend their throw-ins or remember to mark. No, it's a team thing to mark at an opponent's throw-in. So I'm using a lot of time on that. Both, of course, when I'm with the players at training camp or at the former Melwood training ground or the new one, but I'm also focusing a lot on that on my throw-in analysis in every game I do. So they are just so important. But you can't do it yourself. You have to take the whole team into to defend. So, you have to learn that step by step too.
Thomas, just a quick one. Thomas, how many clubs now are you coaching?
I'll say that I think it's not like some people think that, okay, I'm signing X clubs in July and then I'm coaching them all years. Some clubs I'm signing really early, like July, early August, and some clubs I'm signing in November, some clubs I'm signing in January. At the moment, I think I'm up to like seven teams or clubs with this prognosis and the big amount of interest at club. I'll if you talk to me again in May, I'll probably say I've been coaching 10, 12 different clubs or teams. And actually last week I coached my very first national team. And I know what you think now, what national team is it? But I can't reveal it at the moment. So that's also a new thing for me. Of course, it's a big milestone for me because I always dreamed of coaching a national team too, because throw-ins are just as important in national games than compared to club games. But again, back to your question, I'll probably coach 10, 12 different teams this year. And then, like, of course, it's a little bit like a juggling with the calendar, because it's both my calendar and the club's calendar. And there are many different things that can affect, you know, the calendar. One thing is, I hope we don't get so much regulated by COVID-19 this winter compared to last, but it's also about when do they play, and also when do they play Champions League or Europa League or National Cup games and so. So, but again, back to your questions, I'll probably end up with 10, 12 different either pro teams or national teams this season.
Yeah, hopefully you're not coaching AC Milan, Porto or Atletico Madrid.
Yeah, you can say you never know who I'm coaching. And you can also say that it's also really, yes, of course, in the National League, it's really easy for me to control. For example, in the Premier League, I can coach every team I want. You know, if I haven't signed an exclusive contract with Liverpool FC, and I haven't done that. So, but my own like how can you say, ethics are saying that it would be really stupid or bad also for me to coach, for example, Liverpool and Manchester United in the same season. If I hadn't been to Liverpool, it would also be really stupid to coach Arsenal and Tottenham in the same season. So there are, of course, when I'm coaching Liverpool, there are some teams I can't coach, at least in the season where I'm coaching Liverpool. So, but again, back to your question with European football, it's just so hard because, you know, I can start a season, then coach some teams from different countries, and then suddenly they draw each other in European football. You can never say, oh, you know, you can't avoid that totally. You can say in the last season's Champions League, I had coached also Ajax and FC Midtjylland, and Liverpool went in the same group. But I didn't coach them in last season. I coached Ajax the season before, and Midtjylland, I've been coaching them for like 10 seasons, but not the season where I'm coaching Liverpool. And of course, I'm not, all in all, I'm not giving like secrets away from one team to another if they're playing against each other. The only thing I'm normally saying to other teams is what do I do, you know, on the pitch? What is my philosophy? And then trying to learn everything from the bottom there. So so that's just a part of it, you know. It'll probably happen that, because it happened in Denmark, that I coached two teams from the Danish Super League and so at the same time. And when they met, it was a little bit also, how can you say, schizophrenic that you said, oh, fantastic throwing, and in the same time you say, oh, bad marking, you know, because you're coaching two teams in the same game. But that's just the way. That's the way it is. You can say I'm a freelancer. So most other, or 99%, I think, of all people in professional football, they're like hired for the same team for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, and they're only like focusing on that. But I'm traveling from team to team, and you know, I love it. I love it. Some people have asked me, hey, why couldn't it be cool to have a 4-year contract with Liverpool FC, and then you can only coach Liverpool FC? And I'll also say that'll be totally fantastic. But if I have to choose between that and then the freelance, you know, I'll probably choose the freelance, because I'm getting so many fantastic experiences with seeing other countries, other parts of the world, cultures, meeting fantastic people, seeing different environments, you know. Since July 2018, it must have been like, I don't know, 25 or so different teams or so, or 20, 25 different teams. How many coaches I've been meeting, and playing styles I've seen, and how they're everything around the club, how the training grounds are, and you know, so I love that life. So. So, but let's see what happens in the future.
I mean, you've just named some of the teams there. You've coached the likes of Liverpool, Ajax, Genk, Leipzig, Atalanta, Midtjylland. But what for you has been the most exciting role out of the clubs that the public know you've coached with?
I'll say that's Liverpool, and why is that the most exciting role? Yeah, first of all, it's still the biggest club I've ever been coaching, and it's for me there can be nothing bigger than Liverpool. It doesn't mean that there aren't any other clubs as big. I'll say that Liverpool are up in the very, I had to say Super League, but that perhaps the wrong words at the moment. But you know, you probably understand me that for me there are like the big clubs like Madrid, Barcelona, Liverpool, Bayern Munich. We also, even though I know you're Liverpool fans, we also have to count United in, even though it's, you know. But there are like these eight, ten clubs who are like the very top. So it can't, first of all, be bigger than Liverpool. The second thing is that I've been coaching Liverpool for four seasons now. But it's also because I've been getting an open role in Liverpool FC. It's not like someone has said, okay, we have been doing throw-ins and throw-in coaching like this before, then can you adapt to us? No, I've been getting a totally open role, and I also think that's a big part of the success. Jürgen Klopp hasn't said to me, hey, do this. No, they've listened because they knew I had really much knowledge around the throw-ins, much more than them. And so they probably knew if they, let me, you know, give all my knowledge and do the drills I knew could be really good for the team. They just let me have that open role. Of course, I'm listening to the players. I'm listening to the coaches. I'm really fitting my coaching in. So it's not like it's only about me and my thoughts. But I think that's also one of the reasons why I think Liverpool has been the biggest. And then, of course, when you're into a club like Liverpool, you're also getting all this with you'll never walk alone and everything under your skin. I'll also say that scousers in general, you know, are really, really kind people. You know, when I meet people on the street in Liverpool, they're just like really kind. I love the feeling in the city with the dock, with Beatles, with all the museums, the cathedral, you know, everything around it. And for me, it's just like, it can't really, really be any better. So that was a lot of arguments for picking Liverpool as the best one. So I'll say that's for sure the best one. But I'll also say that I've also just, the last couple of months traveled to a couple of places outside Europe where I've been getting some experiences as a human that I haven't had before. You know, I've been traveling almost to all countries in Europe. I've been traveling many times to the Canada and the States, and it's all like this country I went to two times here. It people didn't have much in their life, not many money, lived in poor houses compared at least to Europe, but the people there were so kind and so, and in that country, that secret country, people are not only loving football is their life, you know, it's their whole life. So I met another kind of passion that I meet in Europe. I'm not saying that people is not passionate around football in Europe. Yes, that's totally gigantic passion people have for football in Europe, also in Liverpool. But it was just a whole lot of thing to see that in this other country there. So you know, I'm just taking all I can as a human, as a throwing coach, in the different places I visit. So that's it.
I mean, you mentioned at the start of the podcast that Jürgen Klopp phoned you up on your personal mobile. I mean, A, how cool is that? And B, like, I think all of us, you know, just adore the man. Like, you know, Jürgen Klopp is the best thing to happen to Liverpool, I generally believe, in the Premier League era. You know, I think we all know what he's like, but from your point of view, from being on his staff, like, what is he like as a boss almost, or as a manager, as a person? Because I think we all have such, you know, a wonderful presentation of him. You know, it does that come across to you as well?
Yeah, of course it does, and of course I also really appreciate his the things that, that people can see from the media. Like, of course he's funny, he has a lot of humor. He's also really kind, and that's fantastic. I think that's two really good things to have as a leader, because it make you feel appreciated. But if leaders sometimes also a little bit funny. And not necessarily all the time, but at least once in a while, it also makes people relax. But I think that one of the one of the best things I appreciate around Jürgen Klopp is that he's a very open person. You know, if you're a manager of one of the biggest clubs in the world, you have a lot of power, and you can decide a lot of things. So it takes really a lot of courage to let a pretty unknown man with, for some people, crazy ideas about throw-ins, to let him have a free role. So for me, great leaders, they are trusting their employees. They're giving them, you know, a chance to give their best. So that's what I really appreciate. And to know that about a person, that person, he or she can make that difference. You have to do another thing I think that's really good with Jürgen Klopp. He's a fantastic listener. You might think that if you know so much that you want to talk, but he's really good at listening. So I really appreciate that, you know, with his personality there. So... And I just know that not so many people know that, but I'm actually also like a keynote speaker or motivational speaker. I've been holding more than 500 talks for companies. Also written a bestseller book in Denmark called Lazy Energy. More about that another time, perhaps. But one of the things I'm talking about is relations. And once upon a time in Denmark, there was like this big, really big research with teams from many different companies, and they had to see who were like really like having the best results, who were having the most work joy, so like two things combined. And before that research, they thought, hey, the best teams and the most happy teams, that must be where the people have most education, and where people really are ambitious and want to go up the career ladder there. But they actually found out that the best teams and also the most happy teams at work were actually the teams where they had the closest work relations. So the closer relations we have, the better we enjoy our work, but we also perform better. And when we hear it, it's actually pretty reasonable, because you also know it yourself. If you have a good relation with a person, it's much easier to say, for example, hey, can you help me with that? Because I have a challenge or I have this question. If you know that person, it's much easier. Also opposite, if you have read something fantastic on the internet, an article or so, and then it's much easier to say that other person, hey, I know you have this project. Can't this help you there? But if you don't have a good relation, you know, it's a little bit hard, and you might think that, oh, he or she doesn't really need this, and maybe they'll be disappointed that I found this. And so close work relations are so important. And I think that Jürgen Klopp is one of the many reasons, but a big reason for the good work environment in Liverpool FC. So when you come, especially when you come like me, even though I've been with the club now for the fourth season, you have to remember I'm not there every week. So if you come like an outsider, and so it's even more important to think that to come into a work environment that's fantastic. So every time I come to Liverpool FC, no matter if it's at the old Melwood, the new place in Kirkby, or with them at training camp, I've been there both in Marbella, Evian twice, Austria twice. And so if you come into an environment where people are happy, people are of course working hard and being ambitious, but they're also kind, they're helping each other, also across different departments, and so then you know it's a fantastic place to work. Of course, it also, like every other place, goes up and down if there are something with the wrestles and or other things, you know, but it makes you go safer or better through these challenging periods if you have that fantastic work environment. So again, back to your question, I think Jürgen Klopp is a big part of that. So I really not only appreciate him but also appreciate all the staff and players at Liverpool FC. It takes some work to create that kind of environment, but when you have built it, it's really stable also in challenging periods.
I wanted to ask, what's an average day for you? Like when you go into the training ground, do you talk with the manager first and then take a few players to the side to do your training?
Yeah, normally I'll say a normal training week for me could be like three training days. For example, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then I'm normally coaching between half an hour and 60 minutes. I'll say when I've been working with a club for a while, it's normally between 30 and 45 minutes perhaps. And then when I come to the, like before the first day, we are like agreeing on what is the program for the next 3 days. And first of all, I have all my analysis and the other visits and so I know what to improve. But of course, I also have taken consideration either in the injured players, also talking with performance coaches, physical coaches, because it can be something with the intensity, the different days and so. So I know, you know, how this will work. And then it could also be like some days I can have the whole team. I'm coaching 24 players, and other days I'm coaching 8 players for 20 minutes, and then I get the next 8 and the next 8, so 60 minutes all in all. So it can be different also depending on what program it is. So but on the single day there, I'm coming there, yeah, often starting with a cup of coffee, and then I'm talking with the other coaches. Normally I come in, if it's not a training camp, then we of course are together 24 hours per day, but in a normal day I'm coming in, getting a cup of coffee, talking with the coaches in like a couple of hours before. Then we may go out on the training pits half an hour before the training starts. I'm setting up the cones, I'm setting up the things I have to do, I'm getting the camera done, or the analysis people are filming the training. Then I'm like just waiting for the players to come out, and then of course I evaluate, and then maybe because I see some things in training, not so often, but sometimes I can change the training the day after. So that's like a normal day for me. And with Liverpool FC, the first 2 seasons I had 5 visits per season, of like normally 3 or 4 training days. Of course I can do many other things in the training because I'm not using all the session. But then it's like last season, it like really like I still analyzed all the games on video and sent to Jurgen Klopp and the other coaches there, but my number of visits were like really down to, I can't remember if it was 1 or 2 visits, but it was only because of the travel restrictions to UK. So but normally in my clubs, no matter if it's Liverpool or other clubs, I normally have between 3 and 5 visits per season, and then some clubs I'm only doing a little bit video analysis, and in other clubs like Liverpool I'm analyzing all games. So it's really different from club to club. Yeah.
And finally, before we go, Thomas, just want to ask you, how did you feel seeing Liverpool dominate world football the other week for them 2 seasons? From someone inside the club, what was it, just amazing to see all these players, you know, the characters of them, achieve greatness under Jurgen Klopp?
Yeah, it was fantastic for the club itself, for the players, for all the staff, and for myself. I'm still like, how do you say in English, pinching my arm? I think you say that, because it's still hard for me to believe. So sometimes when I'm just taking a walk in Denmark, you know, thinking about other things, I suddenly realize that I'm coaching Liverpool FC. We've been winning. Yeah, Champions League, Premier League, World Championship for clubs, and you know, and I'm not sure it's true, but then I say to myself, even though it's in the middle of the day, hey, it's right. So it's also been a crazy journey. You know, if I said that to myself as a 10-year-old, where I first saw my cousins Ben and Johnny do long throw-ins And I thought, hey, that's cool. If I said to myself, you'll be a throwing coach for Liverpool FC one day and win everything, you know, then I thought, hey, okay, you're totally crazy. So of course, that means a lot. But it also means a lot with the fans. Of course, there are millions of Liverpool FC fans all around the world. And we also have really many Liverpool fans in Denmark. And one of the things that clearly remember is that shortly after all the titles there, I think it was right after we won the Premier League there, last year in, when was it, July or August or so, because it was extended the season, I was out shopping groceries at the supermarket. And then I've seen an older guy in the supermarket, but not, he looked after me, but many people look after me because, you know, I've been getting at least semi-famous in Denmark. So that's okay, no worries for me. But then when I came out of that supermarket, he was 70 years old or so, he was waiting. And when I came out, he said to me, I just want to say thanks. And then he just started to cry. And then he took up his sleeve here, and then he had a big Liverpool FC tattoo. And I think it was standing, you never walk alone. And he was crying. He said thanks, and it had meant so much. He'd been waiting for 30 years, and you know, that was really emotional. So, and I guess that almost every Liverpool fan has been through that. So it's totally crazy to think how much that affects millions of people around the world. And I'm often, you know, meeting, no matter where I am, Liverpool fans who are, you know, traveling from all around the world. I actually think in the training camp in Marbella, I met we were there in, I think it was week 7 in 2019 or so. I met a fan from Costa Rica or so, who just suddenly were there, and I think he weren't in here because he heard we were in a training camp, and he stopped me too. And so it's not England, just England. It's not just Denmark and the northern Europe. It's like the whole world. So again, it's crazy. This affects so many people. So I'm just proud to be a part of that.
I mean, that is the perfect way to end this podcast, because, you know, that resonates with us three, and I'm sure every single Liverpool supporter who literally went through 30 years without seeing, you know, our team lift the title. And, you know, yeah, I completely echo that man in the supermarket. Thank you so much for being a part of that, because I'm sure we all probably exactly reacted the same way. You know, I was in bits in my living room. I think I'll always remember that night, and I think a lot of other people will who's listening to this. And you know, so yeah, from literally the bottom of all of our hearts, thank you so much for being such a big part of it.
Yeah, you're absolutely welcome. It's a pleasure. So yeah.
But no, thank you very much. And I mean, such an amazing guest that we've had on, and I hope all of our listeners have enjoyed it as well. We are going to wrap it there, but obviously, as always, you know, catch our podcast every Tuesday. We'll be on Spaces every Wednesday and Saturday too. Okay, so do make sure that you tune in for that. We've obviously got Leeds this weekend, up the Reds on that too. But from Matty, Daz, Thomas and myself as well, take care, stay safe, and as always, up the Reds.